and welcome to Religion in the News. This is Brian LeBlanc for the North Carolina Reading Service, and today we'll be featuring articles from The New Yorker, from The Washington Post, from Religion News Service, and more. Today's broadcast is generously supported by White Memorial Presbyterian Church. They can be reached at 919-834-3424, and we thank them for their contribution. The contents of this program are intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our centerpiece article today on Religion in the News comes from The New Yorker, and it's a fairly lengthy article. We'll begin with an article from Religion News Service and then jump over to that one and see how much time that one will probably take up, a decent bit of time. But it was a really interesting article. I'm looking forward to sharing it with you. We'll begin this episode of Religion in the News with an article from Religion News Service dated June 10th. This article, Floyd's Death Spurs Debate on How Immigrants Should Run Stores in Black Neighborhoods. This article is by Aisha Khan of Religion News Service. George Floyd was killed after employees at a convenience store owned by a Palestinian-American Muslim with a Muslim prayer space in its basement called Minneapolis police over a suspected counterfeit $20 bill. The role that the store played in Floyd's death May 25th and in all that followed has been a bitter pill to swallow for many Muslim and Arab communities. This moment has also reignited ongoing debates in Muslim communities over the ethical duties of immigrants who own businesses in black neighborhoods, from when and if they call the police to the role they can play in creating healthier food ecosystems. We now know that escalating situations to the police almost always does more harm than good, even for something as harmless as a fake bill, Mahmoud Abu Mayalay, owner of the Cup food store that called the police on Floyd, wrote in a Facebook post. Cup Foods, which has served customers in a largely black neighborhood for three decades, will no longer involve the police in nonviolent incidents, Abu Mayalay said. By simply following procedure, we are putting our communities in danger, he said in a social media post. Instead, he urged, work within your communities to find alternatives to policing, until the point that local and state officials decide to seriously hold police accountable once and for all. Food and liquor stores, often owned by Arab and South Asian immigrants, are common in mostly black, low-income neighborhoods. But the relationships between these store owners and the communities they serve have often been fraught with racial tension. Imam Makram El Amin of Masjid al-Nur in Minneapolis said Floyd's killing may open up store owners' eyes and lead to a watershed moment in changing the relationship between store owners and the community. Everything is different in the air right now, Al-Amin said in a virtual town hall held last week on the matter. We know not all Arab store owners are bad actors, but there is a narrative around it. There has sometimes been a conflict in a relative to that relationship. Rami Nashashibi, director of Chicago's Inner-City Muslim Action Network, says a massive cultural transformation is needed for non-black Muslim corner store owners to be allies for those they serve. There are many more productive ways of mediating disputes, and we are grateful that this current store owner has publicly declared that involving police will not happen moving forward, Nashashibi said in the town hall. But, Nashashibi emphasized, I think we have to recognize that that call did not happen in a vacuum. Since the police killing, IMAN has partnered with the Muslim Anti-Racism Collaborative, a racial justice education organization, to launch Corner Store Witnesses, a new training curriculum aimed at non-black Muslim business owners. The AIM creator said is to organize for a new reality around corner stores. Margari Aziza Hill, director of Muslim ARC, said the planned virtual culturally sensitive training for store owners will provide the pathway for playing a role towards being a just and righteous witness against the type of violence that we've seen. Already, the organization has hosted conversations on the ethics of doing business in black neighborhoods. The new curriculum is an extension of IMAN's ongoing campaign to diffuse racial tensions between those communities, which Nashashibi argues is critical to solving inner-city neighborhoods' food access crises. We must go beyond the logic and dictates of capitalism when it comes to how businesses operate in urban, disinvested neighborhoods, he said, because that logic has oppressed and abused people, and we are complicit in that abuse. We need to dig deeper, and this is that moment. Since its founding in 1997, IMAN has worked with dozens of corner stores in Chicago's South Side and in Atlanta's West End on campaigns focused on developing healthier business models and building positive relationships between Arab store owners and black residents. Imam Jihad Safir, who heads Isla LA, an inner-city Muslim community center in South Los Angeles, said stores and restaurants run by Muslim immigrants were often the source of alcohol, cigarettes, drug paraphernalia, and unhealthy foods that have taken a toll on locals' health. Beyond over-policing, common concerns with immigrant-owned corner stores include gentrification, exploitative pricing, racist hiring practices, hostile security measures such as bulletproof glass and cages, the sale of alcohol and nicotine products, and the sale of junk food, as well as a lack of fresh produce and other healthy foods. In many ways, residents in those neighborhoods perceive those store owners in the same way those Palestinian store owners perceive Israeli settlements in the West Bank, Nasha Shibi, who is Palestinian-American himself, argued. What justification are you using to be in that black community? Many Arab and South Asian store owners respond to allegations of racism by pointing to their own marginalized identities and their need to protect their income. Many are working class. Some are undocumented. Activist Linda Sarsour, whose father owned a store in Brooklyn's Crown Heights neighborhood for 38 years, urged Muslims not to blame Cup Foods' owner for Floyd's death, noting that the store has a positive relationship with locals. I understand that we have a long way to go to build transformative relationships between Arab and Asian store owners and local black communities, she wrote in a Facebook post. These communities deserve business owners who are contributors to communities, not just takers. But for some, the gulf between store owners and the neighborhoods in which they operate has only grown during the protests. Sarah Hamdan, an IMAN organizer who is Palestinian, said several Arab corner store owners in Chicago's West Side have loudly expressed their frustration over damage done to their businesses during the protests. None live in the same neighborhoods as their stores. Some store owners have had the luxury of removing themselves and seeing these stores as places where they're able to take money and then at the end of the day go back home, she said. For her, she said, that raises a question about accountability. How long did you think you were going to be able to run and operate a store that continued to harm and exploit black folks without reaping what you sow? In a statement acknowledging that many Arab small business owners' relationships with local black communities are rooted in racism and exploitation, Chicago's Arab American Action Network also urged business owners to support the ongoing anti-police brutality protests. Property is not more important than people's lives, the organization emphasized. Brick, mortar, windows, and goods can always be replaced, but a life taken can never be brought back. Now we'll move over to the New Yorker and the lengthy article by Casey Kapp that was dated June 11th. And the title of this article, Is There a Religious Left? Why Progressive Activism Rooted in Faith is So Often Misconstrued. In the name of Jesus, this flag has to come down. So begins one of the most consequential sermons of the 21st century. Bree Newsom, a 30-year-old artist from North Carolina, was a few dozen feet above the ground, scaling a flagpole in front of the South Carolina State House. Police officers were hollering up at her, demanding that she come down, but she kept climbing and kept preaching. You come against me with hatred and oppression and violence. I come against you in the name of God. This flag comes down today. Newsom had been thinking about that Confederate flag for some time. Her ancestors had been enslaved in South Carolina, and she had heard stories from her grandmother about the violence perpetrated by the Ku Klux Klan in Greenville. Then on June 17, 2015, a white supremacist murdered 9 black parishioners during a Bible study at a church in Charleston, and Newsom decided it was time for the flag to come down. 10 days later, after meeting with other activists, including one who had scaled trees for Greenpeace and practicing on a few lampposts, she climbed the 30-foot pole outside the State House, reciting the Lord's Prayer and the 27th Psalm as she rose higher and higher, removed the flag and returned it to the ground, where a crowd applauded and the police arrested her. Newsom spent about 7 hours in jail. The Confederate flag was restored before she had even been released. But by the second week of July, after millions of Americans had seen photographs or footage of her climb, the state legislature voted to permanently remove the flag from the Capitol. And in the years that followed, many other Confederate memorials and statues have come down across the country. The daughter of a Baptist preacher who was once the dean of the Howard University School of Divinity, Newsom came by her faith and her preaching honestly. Yet almost all of the publicity that followed her act of civil disobedience stripped her protest of its theological tenor. Such is the fate of much of the activism of the so-called religious left. It is, if it is successful, it is subsumed by broader causes and coalition. If it fails, it's forgotten. For all the opprobrium directed at the religious right, the activism of religious leftists suffers a different fate, alternately ignored and fetishized, trotted out every election cycle with a tone befitting the Second Coming, always just about to happen. This year's presidential race is the most obvious occasion for the new book American Prophets, The Religious Roots of Progressive Politics and the Ongoing Fight for the Soul of the Country by the reporter Jack Jenkins. American Prophets begins where Jenkins himself began as a religion reporter, in the fall of 2011 at the Occupy Wall Street protest in Boston's Dewey Square, an offshoot of the gathering in New York City's Zuccotti Park. Jenkins was freelancing for Religion News Service, a kind of faith-oriented Associated Press, and his first assignment was to cover the spiritual aspects of OWS. When Jenkins arrived at Dewey Square, he heard protesters singing hymns and followed their voices to the Sacred Space tent. That space was representative of the role he argues religion played in the movement. From the beginning, there were interfaith prayer services, protest chaplains, and supplies donated by local religious groups. Over the next few years, Jenkins chased stories like that one for RNS, as well as for the Center for American Progress's now-defunct Think Progress. His book is a collection of that reporting, not really the history or systematics promised by his title, but a series of portraits of people he argues are part of the religious left, a term Jenkins acknowledges that even some of his own profile subjects would reject, despite his almost definitionless definition. An amorphous, ever-changing group of progressive, faith-based advocates, strategists, and political operatives. As a result, American Prophets is actually kind of a contemporary Lives of the Saints, a series of profiles of admirable leftist activists whose politics are motivated by their faith. Whether those portraits constitute a collective is not only a problem for Jenkins as a writer, but for the rest of us as citizens. It's difficult to say which came first, the religious left or the religious right. In the 19th century, the abolitionist cause was championed by Christians, although many others, going all the way back to the Apostle Paul, had defended slavery on theological grounds and continued to do so even after the emancipation. Some historians identify the social gospel movement of the early 20th century as the real origin of leftist religious politicking, since it applied Christian ethics to a range of issues rather than just one. Evangelists of the social gospel demanded structural remedies for poverty, addiction, child labor, crime, and other injustices. The organizing they did on behalf of welfare, temperance, labor reforms, and public safety prompted a backlash by conservatives, who came together to oppose first the New Deal, and then evolution, communism, contraception, pornography, gays, and abortion. It's a surprising prologue for the contemporary political landscape, where the religious left seems to mobilize chiefly in response to the work of the religious right. Jenkins attends to many faiths, but he begins with a Catholic activist, Sister Carol Keehan, who in addition to being a nun with the Daughters of Charity, was the head of the Catholic Health Association of the United States. In that capacity, she applied her background in nursing and healthcare finance to the management of about 600 hospitals and 1,600 other health facilities across the country, and beginning in 2009, helped draft and lobby for the passage of the Affordable Care Act. She continued to fight for the bill even after the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops came out against it, not only whipping Catholic legislators in Congress, but by writing newspaper editorials about how the bill reflected Catholic principles and challenging the bishops who tried to portray the bill as pro-abortion. So consequential was her activism that Sister Carol received one of the pens that President Barack Obama used to sign the ACA into law. Such legislative victories are few and far between in American Prophets. More common is the experience of the interfaith group Moral Movement Maine, which protested Senator Susan Collins in 2017, pleading with her to protect the ACA's individual mandate. ignoring the 9 Christian, Jewish, Buddhist, and Unitarian Universalist clergy arrested for occupying her congressional office, Collins ultimately voted for the Republican tax bill that killed the mandate, claiming she had secured protections for the insurance provision, although ultimately jeopardizing the health of 80,000 Mainers and millions of other Americans. Those 9 clergies who were arrested were part of the main incarnation of an activist movement started 4 years earlier in North Carolina by the Reverend William Barber II. Barber, a Disciples of Christ minister, had watched as Republicans, having taken control of both state houses and the governor's mansion in North Carolina, enacted a conservative agenda that radically changed his home state, cutting unemployment benefits, rejecting the Medicaid expansion, eliminating low-income tax credits, curtailing voting rights, and slashing education and environmental budgets. On April 29, 2013, Barber led several dozen people to the state legislature, which was in session and interrupted its deliberations. "We have no other choice but to assemble in the People's House where these bills are being presented, argued, and voted upon," Barber wrote in a public statement that accompanied the first Moral Monday's protest, "in the hopes that God will move in the hearts of our legislators as he moved in the heart of Pharaoh to let his people go." 17 people were arrested that day. By the end of that year's legislative session, the number had risen to roughly 1,000, and by the next year there were Moral Mondays groups gathering around the nation. Barber probably has the largest following of any of the figures in American prophets. As Jenkins observes, it is rare for members of the religious left to become national figures the way that many conservative Christians have. That difference is both cause and effect of a weaker centralized movement, but it also reflects the extent to which activism on the religious left is sometimes grounded in local issues. Take Chase Iron Eyes and Dr. Sarah Jumping Eagle, a married couple who helped lead the protests against the Dakota Access Pipeline. Standing Rock would eventually host more than 10,000 protesters from all over the country, but for Iron Eyes it was where he grew up, sacred land he'd long tried to defend. Jumping Eagle was one of the 400 people arrested at Standing Rock, and one of many who saw the pipeline not only as an environmental threat, but a spiritual one. Concern for the environment is shared by many religious people across faith traditions, yet their environmentalism is often presented as a strictly scientific conviction rather than also a theological commitment. It's far more common to hear references to the religious left in conversations about immigration and poverty. Jenkins reports on the work of the New Sanctuary movement, highlighting clergy like the Reverend Allison Harrington, whose Presbyterian church in Tucson provided weeks of safe haven to Danielle Noye Ruiz, a 36-year-old Mexican immigrant who had no criminal record but was stopped for a broken tailpipe and then threatened with deportation. More than 1,000 faith communities are now affiliated with the movement, providing safety from immigration raids, organizing marches and vigils for immigration reform, and sheltering dozens of immigrants every year. Because the sanctuary is a literal religious space, it is harder to ignore the faith-based nature of this work. Elsewhere in American Prophets, Jenkins uncovers the religious motivation of seemingly secular activism, including the Women's March, which organized millions of people around the globe to protest the inauguration of President Donald Trump. Jenkins focuses on the work of the Muslim activist Linda Sarsour, one of the co-founders of the march, who had previously led the Arab American Association of New York, protesting the discriminatory surveillance of Muslims and fighting for the recognition of Muslim holidays in the city's public school calendar. No one knows how many women were drawn to participate that day by their faith, but Sarsour was able to mobilize existing Muslim networks to send countless women to marches around the country, a pattern of religiously supported collective action seen many times before and many times since. These are all compelling figures, and Jenkins, while a workaday writer, is a fine reporter, setting scenes and sweeping his readers across large swaths of geographic, racial, socioeconomic, and religious differences to capture recent political history. It's easy to admire the activism of these individuals, but it's hard to know what to make of them collectively. Jenkins, despite his title, is offering reportage, not theology or theory. Still, it's worth considering why many of the subjects in American Prophets would be among the first to insist that there is no such thing as the religious left. At first glance, the religious left should be easier to organize than the religious right. Many of its Christian constituencies are less doctrinaire and more ecumenical, making its denominations more likely to work together. It is also more interfaith, which means that its coalition should not only be more diverse but also larger, since Christians and Jews work together alongside Buddhists, Muslims, Sikhs, Hindus, and those of indigenous spiritualities. But that is easier theorized than lived, and such coalitions can be fraught. As Jenkins notes, 2 years after the first women's march, Sarsour and the other original organizers stepped down following allegations of anti-Semitism from Jewish activists who claimed that they had been excluded from the movement. Moreover, many religious liberals have a reticent political theology, either because of a commitment to pietism, which may be intrinsic, or a reaction to being offended by the public witness of the religious right, or because of a Rawlsian fear that religion may threaten the project of a pluralist public sphere. Some of that reticence has faded in the Trump era, not only because religious leaders have organized their communities to participate in protests like the Women's March, March for Our Lives, and Black Lives Matter, but because faith organizations themselves have been targeted by the Muslim ban and by military-style policing tactics. This month, priests and parishioners at an Episcopal church in Washington, D.C., together with other protesters, were tear-gassed in order to make way for President Trump to pose for photographs while brandishing a borrowed Bible. In Buffalo, New York, a 75-year-old peace activist named Martin Gugino, who had been involved with the Catholic worker movement, was pushed to the ground by police officers and then left bleeding in Niagara Square. Such activism has become notable, not because it wasn't happening before, but because the president has made it feel so explicitly partisan. Still, most faith-based homeless shelters do not run voter registration drives, and most religiously affiliated food banks and soup kitchens do not organize clients to support politicians who adequately fund their services. And with mainline denominations shrinking, worship attendance declining, and nearly half of liberals under the age of 30 claiming no religious affiliation, it's unlikely that the demographics of the religious left will ever match the electoral might of the right. Some of the most truly radical religious leftists eschew electoral politics altogether and will organize around action but not elections. While liberals may well own the nuns, the nearly quarter of Americans who are agnostic, atheist, or unaffiliated with an organized religion, their lack of affiliation makes it harder to organize around moral causes. American Prophets never adequately contends with these demographic facts and trends. Like much reporting of this kind, it simultaneously understates the prevalence and overstates the potential of religiously motivated progressive activism. Jenkins tips his hand accidentally when he claims that religious groups might be one of the left's most secretive weapons. How effective of a weapon they may be is debatable, but they certainly aren't secret. It's telling that even though Jenkins was explicitly assigned to write about spirituality in the Occupy Wall Street movement, he was nonetheless dumbstruck to find it there. That is all too often the tone of coverage of the religious left. In her book, The Party Faithful, How and Why Democrats Are Closing the God Gap, from 2008, the journalist Amy Sullivan observed the contradictory ways in which religious liberals and religious conservatives are covered by the mainstream press, with the faith of right-wing politicians generally taken at face value, while those on the left are often ignored, treated with skepticism, or disparaged as insincere and pandering. Consider the dismissal of the lifelong Methodist Senator Elizabeth Warren's invocation of Matthew 25 as her personal motto during one of this year's Democratic debates, or the way that the authenticity of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's Catholicism is debated. Chances are you've read much more about President Trump's ham-fisted attempts to woo evangelical voters with prayer breakfasts and talk of 2 Corinthians than you have about the rosary that former Vice President Joe Biden also carries with him. It was the same one his son Beau was wearing when he died. Or the outreach he has done among Catholics in his support for the nuns on the bus in their effort to promote voter registration. If you've heard about Biden attending Mass at all, it is likely only because a South Carolina priest refused him communion after the candidate expressed his opposition to the Hyde Amendment, which bars the use of federal funds for abortion services. Nowhere is this discrepancy clearer than in the way the political press covers the black church. For all the talk of the religious right, one of the Democratic Party's most reliable voting blocs is also one of the most religious populations in the country. Nearly 90% of African Americans claim a religious affiliation, and almost as many rate religion as a highly important aspect of their life. The voter registration and political organizing that has always taken place in black churches often goes without mention, even though Souls to the Polls has been such an effective way of increasing voter turnout that Republicans have tried restricting early voting access on Sundays. The religious left, in other words, is not secret, merely misconceived. Party, for instance, is an inadequate way of representing someone's politics, and matters of social justice can be rooted in faith, but are not exclusive to it. Pro-life leftists exist, as do anti-abortion atheists. Religious leftists are not surging into power this presidential election, or probably any other. But religious voters, especially African Americans, have long formed a base of the Democratic Party in this country. Their fate, like that of Bree Newsom, is often to have their religiosity go unmentioned or unmoored. In Newsom's case, the press covered her protest as if it were a spontaneous, isolated episode of rebellion, when in fact she had been one of the thousands who had marched with Reverend Barber on his Moral Mondays in North Carolina, and had been arrested once before at one of his statehouse sit-ins. The problem isn't that there has not yet been a potent religious left. It's that the religious part is too often left out. Our final article on this episode of Religion in the News comes from the June 5th edition of the Washington Post. The headline, Wilton Gregory, America's only black Catholic archbishop, goes from diplomat to detractor in the wake of George Floyd's death. This article will be edited a bit for time. It's by Michelle Borstein of the Washington Post. Washington Archbishop Wilton Gregory has made a name as a genteel, middle-of-the-road diplomat, a reputation that served him well as he rose into some of the most powerful positions in the U.S. Catholic Church. But the country's only black archbishop rewrote his biography on Tuesday when he sharply took to task not only President Trump, but the country's biggest Catholic lay organization, the Knights of Columbus, after Trump posed for photos outside an Episcopal church near the White House at a Knights-owned Catholic shrine in Northeast Washington. I find it baffling and reprehensible that any Catholic facility would allow itself to be so egregiously misused and manipulated in a fashion that violates our religious principles, he said in a statement. Gregory has put himself in an unusual position for a top U.S. bishop, one challenging church and civic officials at the intersection of religion, politics, and race. In a heavily liberal city with one of the biggest black Catholic populations in the country, the force of Gregory's critique may seem mainstream. But for a U.S. Catholic leader, especially one in the nation's capital, his words were so striking that some people who had worked with him through his career suspected he didn't write them. Others are glad he did. Thank God for Archbishop Gregory, Edward Rankin, a black member of D.C. Knights Council 15723, told the National Catholic Reporter in an interview published Friday. Canon law blocker Edward Peters, on the other hand, tweeted, I find Archbishop Wilton Gregory's condemnation of the National Shrine devoid of any sense or Christian sentiment. On Friday, Gregory made clear the thoughts he expressed were his own. Speaking on a panel about racism that was organized through Georgetown University, he says he sees criticism of him as similar to those hurled at priests and nuns who marched for civil rights in the 1960s. The Knights' willingness to host the president at the St. John Paul II Shrine after the Trump administration ordered a crackdown on crowds protesting the death of George Floyd, he said, was hurtful and inappropriate. John Paul was a man of incredible concern about the dignity of human beings. His whole life he was battling systems intended to destroy weakened populations and deny human dignity. That shrine is a holy place because of the man it honors, and it should never have been used as a place for a political statement, he said. People clinging said to clergy during the civil rights era as well, you shouldn't be in the political area. If we don't work together, I believe we will miss perhaps the most significant moment for real national transition I've experienced. Well, we've run out of time for this week's episode of Religion in the News. We certainly hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Brian LeBlanc, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. We thank our friends at White Memorial Presbyterian Church for their sponsorship of this program. They can be reached at 919-834-3424. We'll talk to you next time on Religion in the News.